From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 30th, when the longtime Capitol Bureau Chief for New York Public Radio broke some news. For Karen DeWitt, that's nothing unusual. She breaks news all the time. But this time, the news was about herself. On Twitter, Karen wrote, quote, "Finally, I get to use this phrase, some personal news. It's been a fabulous ride, but it's time to go," end quote. Her last day will be June 21st, next Friday. Karen DeWitt began her public radio career in 1990, and the world was very different then. A seemingly intractable conflict between Israel and Palestine, Russia threatening nuclear war, Donald Trump making headlines. Okay, maybe the world wasn't all that different, not in every way, but in many ways it was. There was no internet, no social media, no cell phones. WXXI had maybe a computer or two in the entire building. Mario Cuomo was the governor of New York. The average American was beginning to listen to a lot more NPR and public radio, but their biggest source of news was still the morning newspaper. Since 1990, DeWitt has not only been the voice you know on WXXI, her work has traveled to public radio stations across the state, including WAMC in Albany, LIW in Long Island, NYC in New York City, among others. She was also named Media Person of the Year in 2009 by the Women's Press Club of New York State, and her accolades go far beyond that. I can't count them all now. To our listeners, the voice of Karen DeWitt has been one of the constants, a highlight of outstanding journalism, a beacon of reliability. I know plenty of people in politics who haven't always loved Karen's work or her questions, but I don't know a single person who thinks she's been unfair. Over these recent decades, the American public has found more and more outlets that will just confirm their biases. Ostensible reporters will just feed people what they want to hear. Somehow, with those fast-changing waters picking up speed, Karen DeWitt has rowed in the opposite direction. And we as a community, we as a state, we are better for it. Before she says goodbye to public radio next Friday, we're fortunate enough to have this hour with her. And Karen DeWitt, longtime Capitol Bureau Chief of WXXI and New York Public Radio, an honor to talk to you in this capacity. I wish it weren't the circumstances, but such is life, and I'm happy for you. Welcome back to the program. Oh, we just lost. Isn't that an amazing thing? Let's do this. After all of that, struggle to get Karen on, now we've lost her. And maybe that's indicative of what is frustrating the people like Karen who came into politics when there wasn't so much technology and frustration. So what we're going to do is we're going to listen to a couple of pieces featuring Karen, and then we're going to come back and talk about that. There's a few things that really stand out to Karen DeWitt over the years, including her appearance with Scott Simon of NPR. In June 2011, New York approved same-sex marriage, and Karen was on the air with NPR Scott Simon. Let's listen to part of that.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon.
This is what democracy looks like.
Same-sex marriage is now legal in New York. A large crowd gathered in the state capitol to celebrate after the legislature voted to allow gay and lesbian couples to wed. Five other states and the District of Columbia already allow same-sex weddings, but last night's vote makes gay marriage legal in one of the nation's most populous and influential states. The decision last night turned on the vote of a Republican senator who had promised to oppose same-sex marriage in his last campaign, but he said his views had changed in the course of a contentious, months-long debate on the issue. Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio was at the Capitol last night and joins us from Albany. Karen, thanks for being with us.
Sure thing.
Tell us about the scene, 10:30 last night.
It was quite a scene. There were hundreds of pro-same-sex marriage supporters. They packed the Senate galleries. They spilled into the halls for the vote. And after the vote, everything just erupted, cheering, chanting, hugging, crying, people considering wedding plans. One woman told me that now it's menus and venues for her. Opponents, some had been literally on their knees praying before the vote. Afterward, most of them had left. But some, including national traditional marriage groups, the Catholic Church, issued angry statements saying it's wrong to redefine marriage. They're going against God's will. Governor Cuomo, really, he signed the bill with breathtaking speed. He had signed it by 11:55 on Friday night. Mm.
The vote was reportedly knotted up at 31-31 for about 10 days. What broke the stalemate?
It was 10 days of intense pressure for the Senate Republicans because they couldn't figure out, would they lose their seats if they voted yes, or would they lose their seats if they voted no? What really broke the impasse was they came up with this amendment that would grant exemptions for religious organizations, essentially saying that a religious group doesn't have to provide, say, a church hall or catering for any marriage if it's against their beliefs, and it also protects the religious groups from getting sued. And that amendment provided cover for the final two senators to change their votes, including Senator Mark Crisanti from the Buffalo area. And here's what he had to say about that on the Senate floor.
Who am I to say that someone does not have the same rights that I have with my wife, who I love, or they have the 1,300-plus rights that I share with her?
It was a pretty dramatic moment. In the end, though, most of the GOP senators did vote against it. They were helped by 29 Democrats who voted for it.
And here's what Governor Cuomo said last night in signing the bill.
What this state said today brings this discussion of marriage equality to a new plane.
Help us understand Governor Cuomo's role and the possible political impact this has for him.
Well, it's really a key political victory for him. He named legalizing gay marriage as one of his top priorities. And I think that he felt he really needed this to balance what's so far been a really fiscally conservative agenda. He cut the state budget by $10 billion. He cut schools and health care. He pushed a property tax cap. He demanded union concessions. And he refused to renew a tax on millionaires. But winning gay marriage really helps him with his base in New York State. And also, I think he really wants to develop a national reputation as kind of a new Democrat, fiscally conservative but socially progressive. And so far, he's on that track.
And what did some of the prominent thinkers in the gay rights movement who descended on Albany think of the national significance of this passing?
Well, I think it was a real boost to gay rights groups. They've had some setbacks in California. First, gay marriage was legal. Then they had Proposition 8, which was outlawed by a popular referendum. And now there's endless court action. So I think they're hoping maybe the tide has turned for gay marriage.
Karen DeWitt of New York State Public Radio, thanks so much.
Thank you, Scott.
That is just one example over the years of when there have been important moments in the state. Literally day to day, week to week, month to month, the voice that you hear is Karen DeWitt. That's why NPR and Scott Simon turned to Karen DeWitt in 2011 to describe the remarkable story there. And I think we've got Karen on with us now. And I know we don't love the technology, but I hope we can have a nice conversation. Karen DeWitt, how are you?
Hey, I'm here. Yes. Can you hear me?
I can hear you, Karen.
And all right. Well, been, you know, 30 years of struggling with technical stuff, right, to somehow get things on the air every day. That's our lives. Right?
You're not going to miss that, Karen. I know you're not going to miss any of that part of
that
it.
That part I won't
no.
miss. That part
no
I won't
way.
Miss.
No way. Next Friday is the last day. And can you describe for listeners why you decided now was the time?
You know, I just feel like, and I know I don't want to sound, you know, vain or self-important or anything, but I just felt like I should quit while I was ahead. I felt kind of burned out on journalism, as I think a lot of journalists did after COVID and the post-pandemic and the things not getting back to normal. But this last session, you know, things have been really hopping here. I've had a good time covering everything again. And, you know, I just don't want to outstay my welcome. 34 years. Probably long enough, right? So that's why I'm leaving now. It just feels right to me.
Well, I mean, for our listeners would agree with you that you are leaving and you are ahead. You have tremendous goodwill. And one of the things I mentioned at the outset, Karen, was that since your career has begun in public radio in 1990, there's been so much change. I mean, that's obvious in sort of American media and where people get information. You know, in 1988, newspapers peaked. I mean, so there's a lot of change that has obviously happened. But one of the biggest is that a lot of Americans now can figure out what their own biases are and then find somebody who will report exactly in line with what they want to hear. And while that has kept changing and kept gaining velocity, you really haven't changed. You have pushed against that change and been reliable, consistent. And I wonder if that has been difficult. How do you look at that trend in media consumption?
Well, I appreciate you saying that, but I do feel like I feel like I'm not as credible as I was to the general public. There's just more skepticism out there because, like you said, there's so many different, you know, so-called news sources, and you can just pick to, and hear what you want to hear. Even, you know, a channel I listen to quite a bit, MSNBC, sometimes drives me crazy because it's like that. They're just, you know, talking. They're just trying to, like, rile you up about, you know, things, particular political beliefs that you might have. So, you know, I do feel like that's changing. I feel like our listenership is kind of declining and people are, you know, tuning into sources that are either more entertaining or tell them what they want to hear. And that is something difficult to struggle against. I feel like I'm still doing the same thing, but people don't view it as what we're, you know, we're all doing here, which is facts and the truth and trying to give perspective. So that is pretty frustrating. And yeah, I don't know what the answer is. We're in the middle of something really big right now, so it's very hard to see where it goes.
I think that's fair. And I think that, you know, certainly there is some perception in the American public that, you know, NPR is somewhere on the left. I don't love that perception, and I understand it. I think that there's a complex set of reasons for that, which is merits its own conversation separately. But where I really take issue is the idea that there is some sort of an agenda, or someone is telling Karen DeWitt or us at Connections or the WXXI newsroom or Brian Lehrer how to do their jobs and who they have to book and who they talk to and how they report. That has never been true, right?
No, we're really lucky that we don't have that. I mean, I do think, honestly, there's a little more self-censorship that reporters and, I don't know, maybe even you do, Evan, now, because everybody's afraid of getting canceled. But, I do feel like we're really lucky that we don't have, you know, bosses or an organization or, you know, something just to get more clicks or, you know, to be really, you know, out there with our opinions so that we make more money for someone. We do have the luxury of being able to say, hey, let's think about what's fair here. You know, what is the ethical thing to do? So we still are allowed to do that. That's great. I just think that it's not valued as much as it was, honestly, which is, you know, kind of disturbing. And I have to say, I do feel a little bit of guilt that I'm leaving now and leaving the rest of you to figure out what the future is.
So. We're going to do our best. And
yeah, I know. I know you can.
Did you read the Yuri Berliner piece, the former NPR editor, that recent piece? Yeah.
I did read through it. You know, I don't think that everything that he said was true. I could see how that might be his perception. I think there were other articles written after that that were more accurate of the problems at NPR. And I can't remember the name of the author. Maybe you did. It was a woman, and she wrote it for Slate mm-hmm. magazine.
Yeah, I did see that. Yep.
Honestly, that one, I was like, oh, that rings true to me. The things that she said about, you know, the NPR essentially being, you know, she used a vulgar word, show. And, you know, so many organizations are, but they reach this critical mass where they can actually, you know, produce something that comes out, you know, that's good and, you know, is good quality journalism, even though behind the scenes there's chaos. So that's kind of typical. So that rang true. And, you know, the problems that NPR faces right now and that we all do, that really rang true. But I think Yuri Berliner was, yeah, I think it was, you know, maybe that was his perception, but I don't think that's completely true that everybody goes in there with an agenda. They just don't.
Yeah, so I've told listeners, I would love to have Berliner on this show. He's welcome as a guest anytime. And I would love to talk through some of the piece and his gripes. As I've said on the air here, you know, when listeners at first are like, you'll never talk about that. Come on. I'm, of course, we could talk about anything here. That's what we do.
I also feel like he shouldn't. It seemed like he was kind of forced out after he wrote that column. I don't think he should have been. I mean, I guess he resigned, right? I can't remember all of that.
Yeah,
I feel like they kind of forced him out after that, and that wasn't right.
I think it was. I don't want to speak out of school because I don't know everything that went down there. I will say mm-hmm. that I agree with you that when I read his piece, there were. You know, there was maybe a third of it that I was going, this is obviously not true. This is like so misinformed and it's so amazing that it gets through to, you know, Barry Weiss's site. And I'm like, man, this is really, really sloppy. And then maybe a third of it I thought, eh. And then about a third of it I thought, okay, that's fair. And I want to talk about those things. I don't want to just dismiss it all out of hand. I think those things are good to talk about. I think some of it was really weak and sloppy. But I think that, you know, where we go next is a really interesting question. A lot of people think, well, Evan works for NPR or Karen works for NPR. And, you know, I always tell them, no, you know, we're an NPR member station. You know, we're under the NPR umbrella, but nobody's telling us how we do our jobs. And I want to talk to you about fairness. I mentioned at the top that I know that there have been occasional politicians, we'll talk about Cuomo in a moment, who haven't been thrilled with you from time to time. But I am not aware, unless you are, and correct me, I'm not aware of any politician who has outright said that Karen DeWitt is just unfair, consistently biased. And they didn't like you day to day. Has anybody ever told you you're just the worst, you're not fair, you're biased?
Well, very rarely. Just one exceptional person, but I think he was really mad. And it wasn't even Andrew Cuomo. It was the former Senate Independent Democratic Conference leader, Jeff Klein, who kind of lit into me one day that I was biased and NPR was biased and all the other reporters we were all taken aback. We're like, where is this coming from? Because that is just definitely is not true. No, my reputation has been to be fair. And, you know, it reinforces itself, Evan, because people will say to me, yeah, your stuff, it's always so fair. And so then I go into an interview and I'm like, ugh, I hate this person or their ideas. I disagree with them. But I'm like, but wait, everyone says you're fair, Karen, so you've got to be fair. So it kind of has fed upon itself, you know, that I don't want to, you know, I never want to like wreck that reputation with doing anything that wouldn't be, you know, fair. And fair doesn't mean, you know, equivalency of one side versus the other side.
No,
it means,
right.
You know, just trying to keep the perspective and letting the people, if you're doing a story about one thing and someone has an opposing view, let them have their say. Invite them in. Sometimes they won't answer me or anyone, but just say, look, I want to give you the opportunity to comment, you know, on this story. The story will be better if you comment on it. So, that's something I've kind of built my reputation on, and I've tried to do that every single day, day to day.
Well, here's one of the first emails. Comes from a listener who listens, I think, most days to this program and is pretty conservative. And the listener says, the main thing with Karen is she has a professional air, and I don't think I've ever heard her and thought she was partisan.
Wow. Well, that's good. That's good. I take that as an extreme compliment.
Well, I mean, if it makes you reconsider, you still have 10 days to decide you're not walking away. But I think that ship has sailed. Karen DeWitt is my guest here. Karen DeWitt, a longtime Capitol Bureau chief of public radio in New York State and, of course, WXXI. Next Friday, June 21st, is Karen's last day. I want to go back to your first day when, in 1990, you were one, I think you told Brian Lehrer, one of the only women in working in the State House in that capacity at that time. Is that right?
Yeah, there were several women ahead of me, like maybe 10 years older than me, and some of them were bureau chiefs of UPI, one of the local papers here that no longer exists, Albany's Knickerbocker News. So they kind of paved the way for me. They were the first generation. In fact, the organization I belong to, the Legislative Correspondents Association, the women weren't even allowed to be members of it. They had to be members of the Women's Press Club instead. And, you know, they have these historical books called Red Books here that they used to, like, write up different things about different organizations. And it's around, like, 1974, I found it one time. And the men in the LCA had this long, long, long justification of why women weren't allowed in the organization, but they were still equal, and you could see that they were really on the defensive. So luckily, that all happened before I got here. So I'd be more of the second generation of women, but there was a long period where there'd be maybe only a couple of us in the whole LCA, and there'd be like 40 reporters then, so 40 men and just a couple of women. But, you know, I guess I just kind of got used to it, learned how to deal with the more, you know, male-dominated culture here. It's like you're more cynical. People, you know, mock the politicians or imitate them. Nobody talks about anything too personal at work. And I don't know, I kind of got used to it. I had to adapt. It was sometimes difficult, especially when I was younger. The news conferences, the big high-stakes news conferences with the, you know, male governors, and all the male reporters would be like shouting to get their questions in, and just me trying to figure out what's my angle, how do I get my question in. And sometimes it would be, you know, I'd have to be like the 10th questioner instead of now, finally, in Governor Hochul's press conferences, I either get the first or second question, which is like, you know, took a long time to get there. And it's certainly a much different atmosphere with the, with, you know, there's probably, I think, I haven't counted it up, it's at least equal between women and men now in this reporters group. And it does make a difference.
Yeah, what a change. Talking to Karen DeWitt. So when it comes to the state of state politics, in your 34 years, what was the low point of dysfunction, and how far out of that trough of dysfunction are we now, or is it still pretty dysfunctional?
It's a lot less dysfunctional, although in the last week with Governor Hochul reversing herself on congestion pricing, it felt a little like the good, bad old days, because that threw everything into chaos for the end of the session. I would have to say the low point is the summer of 2009, when what was known as the Senate coup took place, and a group of renegade senators, Democrats, ganged up with the Republicans and took over the Senate from the Democrats, who just held the Senate for like a year. And so you had two rival groups running the Senate. And it was just chaos. People running around all the time attracted lots of media attention. One group would try to lock the other group out of the Senate. And at one point, nobody could find the key. And I think they had to, like, come in from a second floor and try to get down there somehow. And, you know, we would have to go there early in the morning, and one group, whoever got there first, would bang the gavel and they would start having their session. And the other group would come in and they would start having their session simultaneously. I mean, when you think about it, it was the most like childish thing to witness. Mm-hmm. But they just could not get out of that loop. And it lasted for over a month, day after day after day. And I have to say it, it was a circus. That's got to be the low point of governance from the time that I was here. If I could just say it was resolved. David Paterson was governor then. The problem was we didn't have a lieutenant governor because he replaced Elliot Spitzer, who resigned in a big sex scandal. And Paterson finally appointed Richard Ravitch to be the lieutenant governor. And then they knew that Ravitch could come in and break any tie with procedural votes. And that finally ended the whole thing.
That is a great trivia question, by the way. Who did David Paterson appoint? Even wonky New York political types might struggle to remember that one. And so much, it seems to me, Karen, is that, of course, there's a lot of ego in politics. But we went through that time, 2009 and around those years. I mean, the Sheldon Silver days. I mean, I remember trying to interview him, and I've never interviewed someone. Maybe you feel differently about Sheldon Silver because you probably talked to him a lot more than I did. I've never interviewed someone more arrogant and more defiantly, you know, just unwilling to actually answer questions, and was indignant at the very idea that he could be questioned. This is where maybe you go, no, Sheldon was actually a pretty gentle guy. But I'd love to hear your take on that.
He was always really hard to figure out.
Okay.
He's pretty inscrutable. But I actually did have quite a bit of access to him. For some reason, he liked public radio. And he also liked New York One, the Spectrum News channel. I think it was probably Time Warner Communications then. And so a lot of afternoons, he would allow myself and the New York One reporter to go into his office and ask him a few questions. So I think he only talked to the news media that he actually liked, and luckily he liked public radio. And, he would be... It was funny because he'd be the kind of person, especially if you're like in a gaggle outside in the hallway, and I'd hear his answer and I'd think, oh, he just made news. He just said such and such was going to happen. And then if you listened to it again, you'd listen to it and say, well, he really didn't say that. So he was really kind of clever not letting a lot of information out. And, you know, of course, we found out why when he got into all that trouble when the U.S. attorney, Preet Bharara, got after him, is that he was living a double life of just, like, insane, intense corruption and, you know, kickback schemes and, you know, kind of extorting people for money. So he had to always be cautious of everything he said because he had this whole secret criminal enterprise going on.
Isn't it amazing to you over the years covering Elliot Spitzer, Sheldon Silver, you know, to certainly an extent, we'll talk about Andrew Cuomo, men, but politicians who somehow think that their life will be better if they can just get away with some of these schemes. And I'm just thinking, that's got to be so stressful to live that double life. How stressful that must be and why they bring it upon themselves. Must be ego.
Well, yeah, I think it, you know, I don't want to get into too much psychoanalyzing, but I will. I think for like an average person can't conceive of it, but I do think that there's quite a bit of narcissism in politicians. Mm-hmm. Personality makeup. How could you go through all they go through, all the scrutiny, all the having to self-promote yourself constantly? You know, if you didn't already have that character trait, you might get that. And I think that they do think that they're just going to be able to get away with all of these things. And, you know, they don't sit there agonizing about, you know, the consequences or feeling guilty about things they might have done. They're able to compartmentalize it and just keep moving on in a way that most people aren't. I mean, that's been my observation, certainly with the ones who have really done a lot of troublesome things behind the scenes.
Brian writes to say, I'm not sure I can remember a time when Karen DeWitt wasn't covering Albany. Brian, there were times when that was 34 plus years ago. And unfortunately, starting next weekend, we're going to have to go back to that time. But there will be others. There'll be none like Karen DeWitt. And that's why we're talking to Karen before her retirement. Paul writes in to say,
I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, and I could do this probably all day, and Karen would probably kill me if I try to just read tributes to Karen. Paul writes, so thankful for her work over the decades. Just want to say thank you. And Mike wants to know, who was the hardest governor to cover? So, Karen DeWitt, you started with Mario Cuomo there, and I'll let you just answer Mike's question first. Who was the hardest governor to cover?
That's really hard to say because they all, you know, had their good points and bad points. And at the time, of course, the reporters like all end up hating the governor, at least whining, griping, complaining. Like I remember when Pataki was in, where I was complaining about him. In retrospect, I see that he was actually always a polite person and very disciplined in how he gave his answers to the news media. Like if he was on a particular topic, no matter what question you asked him, he would just answer the same thing over and over, hoping that reporters would get tired and go home. I don't know. They all had their challenges. Mario Cuomo, it was just a lot. He was such a big personality. He was a kind of an overwhelming presence. He would have some days when things were going on here, like the budget or end of session, he would have like two press conferences a day, bring reporters into his office, and you'd be there for over an hour. And so that had its, that was like so much access that it'd be hard to actually get any work done. You know, David Patterson, who, you know, came in after Spitzer resigned, I think that was hard to cover because he had such a hard time with it. And it was just such a bad time with the Great Recession and everything was always going wrong. And you could see how badly he felt about it that you really felt for him. So I don't know. I can't really say. They were all, they've all had their challenges. Notice I'm leaving out Andrew Cuomo. We'll leave him for a separate discussion, right?
Well, I've got a piece of sound that maybe we can just remind listeners. The governor, I'm going to read from the Associated Press's description of this now. New York Governor Andrew Cuomo told a female journalist she was doing a disservice to women Wednesday by asking what his administration was doing to confront sexual harassment in state government. Public radio reporter Karen DeWitt asked the Democratic governor whether he was considering new policies in light of the national attention on sexual misconduct, as well as the recent resignation of a state economic development official who was under investigation for harassment. Cuomo did not directly answer her question and instead asked her and other reporters what they were doing to address harassment in their organizations. I think we've got sound of that. Is that right? Let's listen to some of the sound there.
Nevertheless, you did have it going on within your own administration, allegedly, with Sam Hoyt. What could you do differently to, you know, kind of pick up on that?
Well, look, you have it going on in journalism.
Yeah, I know.
What are you going to do differently?
But the question is about state government.
Yeah, it's about state government. I could tell you later in great detail about that if you're interested.
No, it's about you and journalism. And it's about you and journalism. And it's about state government. And it's about carpentry.
Is your administration going to do anything differently to maybe be a little bit more
aware? We will have policies in state government, obviously, that affect state government. But I think you missed the point. When you say it's state government, you do a disservice to women, with all due respect, even though you're a woman. It's not government. It's society. It was Harvey Weinstein in the arts industry. It's comedians. It's politicians. It's chefs, right? It's systemic. It's societal. It's not one person in one area. It's not just Charlie Rose, right? It's not just Matt Lauer. It's not just journalists. It's societal.
Okay, I
understand the breadth of the problem.
Just name one thing.
It's called the state of the state. Come and cover it and see the agenda.
I mean, that is for I like that we're both laughing now. Let me just say, let me just state my admiration for what you did there. And I hope listeners were really paying attention to the fact that that awful answer from Governor Cuomo was nothing but a deflection, because either he didn't want to answer it or he didn't have an answer for it. So he's deflecting to, well, you know, what about? It was classic whataboutism, and you kept redirecting him. Yes, you're right. It's an issue in journalism. I'll talk to you later about that. I'm sure our bosses are working on that. What are you doing? And he kept deflecting. You kept him so laser-focused on it when he wanted to deflect that finally he gave up. I thought that was a masterclass, Karen.
Wow. I actually hadn't thought of it that way. Well, he was obviously in a very bad mood that day. Remember that? He hadn't answered questions from the media in a while, and we could just tell. In fact, he said something like really mean to a male reporter that didn't get as much attention that day. But he was in a horrible mood. And, you know, I actually thought about if I ever found myself in this kind of a moment, because there's a predecessor of mine who worked for the New York Post, Fred Dicker. And he got in an argument with Carl Paladino. Remember Carl Paladino, the Republican who ran for governor, was a precursor to the MAGA Republican Trump-like people. Well, so Carl Paladino lit into Fred, and Fred argued back, and it became a viral, you know, piece and one of the first, you know, viral videos. And I just thought, that's not going to be me. Like, if that ever happens to me, I am going to just really hold my tongue no matter what the politician says, because I don't want to be the star of it. But I knew that day when Cuomo started saying the stuff about being a disservice to women, I thought, this is the news of the day. Here it is. I'm in the middle of it, and I'm in it. And, like, I knew it in the moment. And so I just tried to hold my ground and, like you said, redirect him, but without getting in an argument with him. If we were in private, I would have argued with him. Believe me, I had bigger arguments with him in private than that argument ever was. I mean, it didn't even seem like that was, you know, the way Andrew Cuomo would act sometimes. That didn't even seem completely out of line for him. But I was totally aware that saying that in a public setting the way he was at the beginning of the Me Too movement was just really, he was going down a road to disaster that day with those statements. And I just, you know, I wanted to get answers from him, but I didn't want to become the story any more than I already was.
Well,
so
I know.
It's like that one thing Andrew Cuomo taught us. You think on your feet in the moment. And, you know, I have to say, as much as, you know, when he resigned, I like kind of hoped that like I would never have to talk to him again. I do miss that he did keep you on your toes in that way.
And have you spoken to him after his resignation?
Yeah, I did once. It was a private conversation.
Okay.
It was recently.
Okay. I won't ask you the character.
It was healing. It was healing, you know.
Okay. Karen DeWitt, a longtime Capitol Bureau Chief of WXXI, New York Public Radio, will mark 34 years and retire next Friday, June 21st. And, you know, the kind words for Karen keep pouring in here. Tom says, I remember teaching a workshop on news writing for the entire WXXI news crew, probably around 1992. Karen DeWitt was not only the star pupil, she should have been teaching and I should have been taking notes. She is a treasure. Roger.
Okay, I'm disagreeing with Tom right there. I remember that very differently. I remember that Tom, I was amazed. He honed right into my writing faults. I was shocked that he knew them because I knew them too, like all the parts that, you know, that everybody has that are their kind of, you know, down little bit of downfalls in writing. I remember him honing right into them. I was like, oh, my God, I've got to improve my writing. So I remember it the opposite. But
well,
anyway, he was very helpful to me that day.
He's clearly been moved by your work. Roger says, thanks for all the years of high quality reporting to Karen. So happy for her, but sad for the public radio listening public. Wishing all the best. That is from Roger. And you've heard from a number of politicians, both publicly and I'm sure privately. On the subject of fairness, I just wanted to ask you briefly, Karen, when you have politicians who you've covered thanking you for your work, is there part of you that thinks, wait a second, you shouldn't be thanking me. Maybe I wasn't tough enough on you. And is there part of you that thinks, no, this is good. I was fair. Because like I wrestle with that, too. I think, how much do I want political leaders to think I'm doing a good job? Because I know a lot were frustrated with you at times.
Yeah, I mean, if they were thanking me in, like, the midst of my career, it'd be different. And I'd be like, maybe I am being too soft on them. But, no, I think at the end it's totally appropriate because I think, you know, overall they believe in democracy, too, certainly the ones that thanked me or gave tributes to me, that they see the larger picture of the role, the essential role that we, the media, play in democracy, that, you know, if we're to keep the democracy going. So they do get that, even though they're frustrated a lot of the time with us and we're frustrated with them. They get that it's a necessary thing because what else do we, if we don't have that, you know,
well,
we've got, you know, dictatorship, we've got, you know, Russia, you know, in its current state, which would, you know, we don't want that.
Nope, we definitely don't. I have a couple more listener questions for Karen before we let her go. We got to take this only very short break, and we'll come right back with Karen DeWitt, longtime Capitol Bureau Chief for WXXI New York Public Radio. Coming up in our second hour, a special rebroadcast of a recent conversation on Connections in which we sit down with JoyWave's Daniel Armbruster, the front man, is joining us because the band has a new album out. It's their fifth studio album, and it's one of the most insightful conversations I can remember in recent memory. He takes us inside his songwriting, the lyrics, the process of creating music, and more. JoyWave's Daniel Armbruster next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Lauren writes to us to say, I'm a Geneseo grad. Is it true? Did I hear that Karen DeWitt went to Geneseo? And if she did, what does she think of SUNY now? Karen DeWitt?
Right. I think SUNY's still fairly good. I mean, they've been underfunded, and that's been a struggle. And, you know, I think a lot of the professors aren't really happy about the way it is. But, yeah, SUNY Geneseo was great. I mean, I had my internship at WXXI working on the children's news show, the Assignment the World. And that was a really fun experience. And I did really like at the time that SUNY Geneseo, they really gave like a lot of practical hands-on kind of courses for, you know, writing and how to be a good broadcast journalist. And I don't know, it was a beautiful little town to go to be at college at.
My concern now is that students, journalism students, are going to feel like there's not a career and a future. There's more layoffs than hires. It's going to be hard to make a living. I can do something else. And, you know, I know you and I have talked about that in the past. I want to give you some space to talk about if that continues to concern you.
Yeah, it does. I have to admit, when I talk to younger people now, I tell them they should go into a trade, honestly. You know, electrician, plumber, because you're not going to be replaced by AI. And I'm half serious about that you have to look at that. You know, how many jobs are going to be there in the so-called knowledge industry. And, yeah, I don't know about journalism. I think it has to be like it was for me. You have to do it more than you want to do anything else. And you have to be not suited for anything else, is in my case. And if that's all you like to do and that's what you want to do, then you've got to go for it. and that's fine. But, you know, it's going to require more sacrifices, a little bit more hardship. And, you know, you may not be able to make the money that, you know, you really want to make. You might have to partner with someone who makes more money here, you know, but it's sad to say. But yeah, I mean, I do. I am concerned about that because there's so much churn, especially here at the local commercial television stations here in Albany. The churn is just astonishing how many younger reporters leave. And you would think that would be the most fun job in the world, being a local TV news reporter. At least it used to be several decades ago. Get to run around everything, be live on the air, but it's crushing them, and they're leaving. And that's not a good sign. Something has to change.
Let me grab a phone call in Greece. This is Frank, who's been waiting. Hello, Frank. Go ahead.
Hello. I love Albany News. I love Capitol Press Room. I love Legislative Gazette.
Great.
But I understand you want to leave, and I just want to requote what your colleague Mordecai Lipschitz said. Mordecai, in your motorcar, he said, it's very important to leave before it's time to leave.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was what you were saying earlier, right, Karen, that you want to
exactly
leave while you feel ahead.
No, I think that's true. And I've seen, you know, examples of that through my life, that, you know, the people that stayed too long, and including at this, you know, at the Capitol. So I don't know. It just feels right. I like, there's a lot of, even though their lives are going to be harder than mine, they're not going to have a job probably for 30 years that they love. There's a lot of younger journalists, particularly here right now, who are really doing a really good job and are stepping up to the plate. And I think there's other people that should do this job at this point. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to rest for 6 months, but I'm going to do something else eventually.
Steve wants to know, can Karen comment on, quote, three men in a room? I mean, I assume what Steve means is the way things get done in Albany. And that was the phrase I heard all the time when I came to New York State to work in 2003. Obviously, the governor is a woman, and certain things have changed. But Karen, do you want to first describe the idea of three men in a room and how accurate you think that phrase was?
Right. Totally accurate. The governor and the two legislative leaders would meet in the governor's office and essentially hash out everything about the budget, every major policy agreement. I mean, granted, the leaders would have to go back and run it through their conferences. But the leaders had a lot of influence in telling the rank and file members, look, this is good for you. Trust me here. You know, I'll get this for you in exchange. And it was a lot of wheeling and dealing. And it went on behind closed doors. And the reporters in the old days would just have to wait in the hallway outside the governor's office for hours on end, days at a time. So that the governor, the legislative leaders would come out, and then they would give their version of the meeting, which would always be fun because some days you would hear three different versions of it. Or one of the people would come out. You were mentioning Assembly Speaker Sheldon Silver. He was really good at this. If he knew that he was coming out first out of the meeting, he might say something to the media that would provoke the other legislative leader who was Republican in those days and set something off so that we'd ask or ambush the other leader. And it was just, you know, a lot of drama, a lot of game playing in that way. Now, Governor Hochul, you know, obviously now it's two women and a man. I don't think they actually meet in the room anymore. I think Governor Hochul just calls up Senate Leader Andrea Stewart-Cousins, Assembly Speaker Carl Hastie, and, you know, they talk about things. Both of the two newer leaders, they do, you know, take their members' opinions into account a lot more. They'll always say, well, I don't speak for all of my Democratic members. You know, I have to ask the Democratic members. They try to make it at least seem like they're including them. And it's not as much of a hierarchy. So that has really changed. And we don't wait in the hall on the second floor anymore. So I kind of miss that because it would be kind of fun to hang around and talk to everybody. But, you know, certainly that would suck so much time out of every day that it's kind of good that they're doing it this way. Not that anything is any more open, but they do feel like, you know, they're trying maybe a little bit more to at least include more senators, more assembly members into the mix.
Andrew writes to say that I glossed over a scandal with Governor Hochul that Karen mentioned earlier this hour. I don't think I glossed over. Maybe Andrew is referring to what happened late in the session that sort of derailed things, the congestion pricing. That's a little bit more of a downstate issue, but do you want to describe that?
Yeah, it's not a scandal yet. I mean, it has the makings of certainly a controversy. Governor Hochul decided that 2 days before the session was going to end that she was not going to allow the congestion pricing to take effect in New York City and Manhattan, all streets south of 60th Street. They had the gantry set up, the cameras, to charge people a minimum of $15 if you're in a car, and I don't know, it was $20, $30-something if you had a truck, to get in and out of the center of the city. And that's because if you've been to New York City anytime in recent years, you can't get through Midtown in a car. And, you know, you could try to take, you know, Uber or drive, and you just get stuck in crazy long traffic jams. And this was a way that, you know, places like London have used pretty effectively to get rid of so many cars. And the governor, you know, maybe it was a good idea because it's all about the 2024 congressional races. There's a lot of swing districts, the Hudson Valley, Long Island, with a lot of people who commute in their cars to New York City, but she just handled it in a very clumsy way so that everybody ended up mad at her. And it ended up kind of, you know, the session ended in chaos with a lot of bills not being passed that were close to being passed, especially some environmental and anti-climate change bills that just didn't get through. And the MTA, Metropolitan Transportation Authority, is left with a $1 billion hole in its budget. The lawmakers were so mad, they said, we're not going to just figure out in a day how to, you know, make up for this money. And so I wouldn't call it a scandal, but it's certainly the most controversial thing that she's done. And I think we might see the tide turning where she kind of had this grace period for about 2 years. And now it just seems like the gloves are off and a lot of the rhetoric that started to heat up late last week here.
Even with her own party, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. That's right. I know, because it's all Democrats in power.
Yeah, and, right.
Many of the progressive Democrats, leading Democrats, Senate Finance Committee Chair Liz Krueger, who represents that part of Manhattan that would have congestion pricing, her constituents wanted it, was really pretty harsh in her rhetoric in a way I hadn't heard before.
Before I let you go, I also heard that you moonlighted on This American Life years ago as well here. I don't know this story. What happened there?
Oh, my goodness. That was like quite a time. I guess that was during the coup, and Ira Glass just showed up one day, and he was doing a story on Richard Ravitch, who we mentioned. I, you know, leave it to Ira to take the unusual angle on a news story. And he was interviewing various reporters, and I listened to This American Life a lot, and I thought, oh, I know I could probably get to partially be the narrator for this because they always use someone for the narrator. I'm like, I know the style of this show better than the other reporters. So if I talk to him, I can probably, you know, get a part on this show. And so I did, and, you know, learned a lot of interviewing techniques from Ira, by the way. It was really good. So it was kind of exciting because it took a slice of our life. The backstory on that, Evan, too, is Jay Gallagher, big reporter for Gannett News, wrote for the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, a lot of ways drove state news coverage. In the midst of this, when we were taping This American Life, he passed away, a very untimely early death from cancer. And Jay is also featured in that segment. So, like, I felt like, to me, it really was my American life. It was just a very meaningful show to do at that particular point in time when we were all like really, really blown away by losing Jay.
Karen, I know there are a lot of asks of your time in these last 2 weeks. I know it's busy. I know you want to kind of run through that finish line and then enjoy retirement. I just want to thank you for hanging in there with the weird tech and the back and forth. But for our listeners, this is a hard one. It's hard to lose your voice. You've been so central to their understanding of state politics, state business. And so on behalf of the Connections audience and really just myself and our colleagues here, thank you for making time today and thank you for the work that you have done. It's really been an honor. I hope we can stay in touch.
Well, I appreciate your kind words. It's been an insanely awesome career.
Karen DeWitt, we're going to let you go. Thank you, Karen.
You're welcome.
You get to hear Karen for the next 10 days and the last day, June 21st. I just also want to tell listeners, I just want to make a point to that listeners understand that Karen really has been phenomenal for WXXI, and there are times where it seems like Karen's just a WXXI employee. Karen's voice is heard across the state. There are, you know, so many listeners who think that Karen is their local reporter, their local correspondent over in Albany. And that is just a testament to how well she knows the state, how well she knows the players, the politics, and how much time she gives to all of us when we ask. It is not easy to do that. She will not be replaced. There will be other people who do the work. But there's only one Karen DeWitt. It's one of the reasons I know that in our last pledge drive, people, and I'm not, you know, not pitching you now. If you're a member, great. And if you're not, that's your decision. But people, I cannot tell you how many people said, it's Karen. You know, Karen's one of the big reasons that drove the decision to become a member of public radio. And that is not unusual. So we're going to miss Karen DeWitt, but we're going to move on and know that her legacy, we're all going to try to carry it forward in various ways. That's also going to embarrass her. She gets tired of people saying nice things about her, but she deserves it. We do have more connections coming up in just a moment.